From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, rules for protest. As more Americans take to the streets, what makes a successful protest? And rules for civility in the public square in the age of viral video and viral hate. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Most Americans have never attended a protest or demonstration. They haven't had to. But in the era of American politics, a growing number are flocking to protest, and one can argue that it's because many feel that the political system is malfunctioning. So when people feel unfairly cut out of the political system, that the rules of democracy are no longer being honored, and that bad faith actors are taking the nation in the wrong direction, should anyone be surprised that things are getting uncivil? Temperatures are rising, protests are erupting. But do protests matter? Are these just temper tantrums and expressions of frustration, or can protests create political change? Dawson Barrett has written about the history of protest movements in the United States. He's a professor of U.S. history at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi. His latest book is The Defiant, Protest Movements in Post-Liberal America.
Well, the history of the United States is really a history of protest. Protest is so fundamental to our history. And before the American Revolution, that was a protest movement that involved all kinds of marches in the streets and boycotts. The movement in slavery was a protest movement. The movement for women's rights and women's right to vote. Many, many anti-war movements. And, of course, the biggest waves in U.S. history were the waves of the 1930s that resulted in the New Deal and basically the emergence of the middle class, and then the changes of the many movements of the 1960s, whether we're talking about civil rights or women's rights or LGBT rights or the anti-war movement. This is a constant throughout U.S. history. This is one of the ways that democracy plays out.
Who typically engages in protest?
Essentially, every group of Americans has participated in protest. My first book is about the history of high school protests, and it turns out that teenagers have been going on strike in this country for over 100 years. That said, generally the people at the top don't protest because they have other ways to sort of shape politics, with their influence. So really, protests are ways to influence politics by people at the bottom.
What makes a successful protest?
Well, broadly speaking, and again, this is sort of a historical view, protest movements succeed when they can pressure the people at the top, the decision makers who can actually give movements what they want, whether that's factory bosses or politicians. And almost always this requires disruptive action, behavior that can't be ignored by the people at the top. So we can think of the 1960 lunch counter sit-ins that disrupted businesses at diners, or labor strikes and boycotts that disrupt profits. Basically, movements have to be able to do something that the people who can actually give them what they want don't like. And frankly, that almost always involves votes or money.
A protest that can be ignored is not really a protest?
It can still be an expression. All kinds of pickets outside of businesses are free speech expressions, but they may not influence the people inside. Those are tactics of protest, and they're whether they work or not is really a matter of context. If 100 people picket outside the White House, President Trump can ignore that easily, or Governor Abbott could ignore that easily. But I'm a teacher, so if 100 of my students picket outside of my office, I might reconsider my homework policy. So it really is about pressure.
So right now in the American atmosphere, we're talking a lot about what is appropriate, what is civil in protest or not. We're seeing some individuals like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House spokesperson, being shunned at a restaurant, being told you can't eat here. Other people who also work for the administration being dealt with, with some sort of public shaming. Spokespeople for the right who say this is out of bounds, this is not appropriate. Is this something that is in line, that these types of efforts to shun and shame these administration officials, is that out of character with the history that we have of protest in America?
I'm happy to have a conversation about what's a nice thing to do and what's not a nice thing to do, but, I mean, frankly, historically, that's a silly position. You know, during the American Revolution, protesters would burn puppets, you know, basically burn politicians in effigy. They would burn down houses. I mean, the labor movement in this country, the long history there is actually having armed battles between security forces and workers. The idea that we need to be civil to protest, frankly, it just doesn't make sense. I think it is something that is perpetuated by people who are on the other side of it. You know, locking children in cages is not civil behavior either.
So having a public protest, you know, whether or not it's a marching through the streets or a gigantic rally or hissing at someone as they go into a restaurant, typically we don't normally have to do that in America because we are a democracy, and that when we have the vote that we're able to put people in power who create policies that are going to reflect the interest of the majority of the people. And then we have an attitude like these are the rules that we're going to play by, and eventually everything will work out because we have faith in our system of government. Now that we're seeing so much protest activity, well, let me just stop there and ask you the question. Do you think we are seeing a high level of protest activity?
Yes and no. I think without question, we've seen several kind of major protest waves in the last few months. But, you know, basically what my book is about is actually we've seen constant protest for the last 50 years. And there are many books about how that was a constant for, you know, the 200 years before that. I mean, I think realistically this is just a constant part of democracy, that voting is one part of it and protest is another part of it. I do think it's getting additional attention right now, and perhaps the numbers are bigger because so many people are fed up with how the system is working, and that there doesn't seem to be a lot of political compromise. The president also was not elected by a majority of the people. I think those issues do kind of lead people to protest when the other options are closed, for sure.
Well, the last time I saw this much political protest activity was when the Tea Party came into came into the public square, and they were fighting against the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I mean, the Tea Party certainly is worth talking about, but you know, it was dwarfed by Occupy Wall Street. So I think that narrative, the Tea Party was certainly politically potent, but the numbers were actually quite small by comparison to many other movements since then. I would point to, you know, not just what's going on right now, but if you look at even sort of the moments since the Tea Party, I mentioned Occupy, the movement for Black Lives, the big standoff at Standing Rock, and now we've had a wave of high school students protesting for a gun change. We've seen teachers going on strike all over the country. And then, you know, in the last few weeks, 2,000 people have been arrested as part of the new Poor People's Movement. So I guess I would say, you know, it feels like it comes in clumps, but really it is a constant in our history.
When we have a population of people in America, and right now it seems to be the majority of voters, since how the majority of voters did not support Donald Trump's presidency, he won through the Electoral College. The majority can assert that they have no voice in national politics because the governing party has no interest in representing the minority. They're only interested in pushing forward in representing the majority, or the people that elected them. So if you're part of the voting majority, then you actually are locked out of the political process right now.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think a lot of people feel like many of the policies that are going through right now do not represent what they would like to see. But again, you know, the idea of voting being our democracy, I mean, that, first of all, it doesn't reflect the huge number of people who are not allowed to vote at many times in our history. But, you know, even today, that's a way that you can use your voice a few days, you know, every few years. But protesting is a way that you can influence democracy every day. And, you know, same thing with political donors. Like, you know, people with lots and lots of money can steer politics every day, not just when they vote, but through their everyday actions. And so I think we really need to understand democracy as a much bigger conversation that involves a lot more things than just voting. And historically, that is what has changed. You know, elections matter, but protest movements have radically changed U.S. history. They are a big part of why we have any of the good things we have.
You mentioned Occupy earlier, and that was something you're holding that up as an example of a successful protest?
I would hold it up as a large protest, and just how widespread it was, and how many millions of people participated in, you know, every city and town all over the country, but also all over the world. Whether it's successful or not is sort of a different discussion, and it's a lot harder to measure, in part because it was, you know, crushed rather violently. So, you know, its impacts are really in how we discuss inequality and how we discuss government obligations and how government should be helping the poor, or, their big 99% versus the rich 1% is absolutely had staying power. And it was a big part of the debate between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. So success isn't as easily measured as we might like.
Well, let me just put this out there as this is how I would measure success for a protest movement. If you're able to bring about sustained political change, policy change, and Occupy, they may have been able to get numbers out onto the streets, but they were never able to communicate a message. They were never able to get into, or very rarely, get into the political sphere and bring about policy changes.
Well, I would agree with you that immediate policy changes aren't tangible there. But I'd push back, and mostly this is as a historian. You know, when we talk about the New Deal, which is, you know, the changes of the 1930s are one of the greatest changes in U.S. history. Getting rid of child labor, establishing Social Security, a minimum wage, all these things. You know, that was a 50 or a 60-year movement, not a 2 or 3-year movement. So it's really difficult to look at Occupy and say it was especially successful or a clear failure, because we don't know what comes next. So I think with hindsight, we may see all of these movements adding up to change, or not. You could be correct.
Sure. So here we are today. We're on the cusp of a new protest era. Do you think we are?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think you can certainly see, after the election of Donald Trump, you know, right off the bat, beginning with major protests in D.C., and then the next day, the women's march all over the world, and then the occupation of airports, and then there have just been, you know, every few months it seems like we're seeing a different expression of discontent, really. So I think that's fair.
And then we had this idea, the group consciousness of Americans, that we had these backstops that would protect many of our rights in the country, and those backstops are failing. And many people are looking at the recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court, which were, 5-4, kind of supporting the structure that's in place now. And many people feel like some of these safeguards are failing. The checks and balances aren't there that we had been told would be there. And so they're saying, well, maybe we should take to the streets.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I don't think that's a very controversial perspective that, you know, a lot of the things that we are witnessing are undemocratic, sort of on a fundamental level. And I think there is a lot of frustration. I mean, protest is certainly an expression of frustration, but people who study social movements say it's not just frustration, it's also the belief that it'll make a difference that really brings people out in big numbers. And so, I mean, I think we saw it, with recent school shootings, that these are things that have been happening over and over again. So why did we see this flip right now? And part of it is that we are in this moment where there have been protest movements very recently that these students witnessed, but also, for whatever reason, they do believe they can win.
So, but there needs to be, some level of expectation of someone who says, that's it, I'm done, I'm going to go out and join the protest. What should their level of expectation be in doing so? I mean, just showing up and engaging in the back and forth chants, how is that going to change what the policymakers do?
Well, I think that's a really good example because, if you look at the things that these high school students have been doing, You know, they had a lot of walkouts that empowered students, and then they had public marches that, you know, parents and teachers and other concerned citizens could join in as well. But they're not just chanting. They're actually going after the money. They've been targeting major contributors like Publix, the grocery store chain that supports NRA candidates. They've gone directly at people like Marco Rubio. So they're using those chants to try to pressure the people at the top.
Last election cycle, had there been a candidate called non-voter, that candidate would have won. We still have a majority of non-voters in the United States. If things are so bad, if people are protesting, why aren't they voting?
Well, I think that's a key question. I mean, there are kind of multiple answers. You know, one is that there's been a very deliberate and active attempt to keep people from voting. The voting restrictions of the last decade have been very major in every state in this country. So we can't say that it's just apathy when there are actually deliberate attempts to keep people from voting. But that said, there have always been throughout our history people who are checked out, who are not interested in voting. But then you also have to look at the two parties, and, you know, you can talk to people, and many people even in this election cycle said, on the things I care about, I just don't see a difference between these two candidates. And so, you know, that is one of the downsides of a two-party system, is when they agree on something, then you don't have someone else to vote for. That said, I don't think the two parties are the same, but they do overlap on several key issues.
I go to a lot of these protests in my job as a reporter, and I got to say that many of them are really boring. They're not interesting. They're not entertaining. It's really just dreadful to be there. Why don't they make them more interesting? Why don't they make them a show? Why don't they think about, you know, this is how we're going to engage people? Why don't we take advantage of the opportunity that hundreds of people turned out for this thing? Let's have a razzmatazz to help energize and educate our rank and file here.
Well, I think that's a very fair critique. That, you know, there are actually sort of segments within protest movements, especially in the globalization, anti-globalization marches of the 1990s that brought in puppets and were trying to be more humorous and more creative. That said, you know, when we talk about kind of the issues that we're confronting, whether it's war or imprisoning children, or students who are shot, it's very hard not to be to seem glib.
The politicians think they were there to hear them, but it would be great to show up and see a little bit more than that.
Yeah, indeed. And actually, you know, you mentioned, you know, Occupy Wall Street and Zuccotti Park, and actually, you know, plenty of musicians showed up to play.
What about social media protest? That's got to be a new wrinkle in the way that Americans express themselves. Is that showing to be a way to neuter people and kind of keep them like, you go ahead and do your little Facebook post and tweet away and let the adults govern? Is there any proof that social media protest is actually impacting decision-making?
Well, I think that's a really complicated question. I mean, I think in some ways this is provable, and there are people who study this and try to look at, you know, the data. But, you know, for every example that you can show where someone who might have gone out to protest, but instead they can just, you know, like a Facebook post instead, I think you also see great things that come for protest movements from the internet. I mean, for one, events that nobody would have heard about 50 years or 100 years ago spread virally very quickly. And so that is, I mean, that's a big part of why Occupy was as successful as it was, or the labor protests in Wisconsin in 2011. You know, a few people showed up and took pictures, and then people saw those pictures, and then they showed up. So I think that happens. I think we also saw it just this past week where there was a couple who set up a fundraiser for Raices, who provide legal representation to immigrants. And, you know, they hoped to raise like $1,000, and they've raised like $15 million or something like that. So it's not, I think that it's fair to say that it could be disempowering, but I also think that it's empowering to see other people caring about the things you care about.
But at the end of the day, is it about getting out of your house and showing up and picking up a sign and doing that call and response chant?
It can be. You know, I think that, you know, being in the streets matters, especially when it's disruptive. I think it matters that people in the past few weeks have been showing up. But we've also seen politicians and businesses, you know, do an about face after being bombarded by people on social media. So, you know, it's really just another way to have, your vote kind of pressure people, you know.
And nonviolence. I mean, how important is nonviolence in successful protesting?
I think nonviolence is a necessity. I think some of the ways that we define violence are really tricky, that we, you know, can get into some debates about what is violent and is not violent, when we might just mean not civil or not nice or militant. But, you know, historically, in the United States, when people other than government figures do violence, everybody else thinks that they're crazy. So I think that historically, protest movements do not benefit from being framed as violent. I think that that's scary, and I think that numbers matter. I think mass movements matter. I think protests need to build larger numbers, and I don't think that violence accomplishes that. So far from being just a moral argument, I think as a strategic argument, I don't see a lot of evidence that, at least in our history, that violence is successful.
Dawson Barrett is a professor of U.S. history at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi. His latest book is The Defiant: Protest Movements in Post-Liberal America. He also wrote Teenage Rebels: Successful High School Activist from the Little Rock Nine to the Class of Tomorrow. There's been a lot of talk about civility in the public square this week, but those who are now clutching their pearls may not have been paying close attention. Rude behavior thrown in the face of people just doing their jobs has been going on for over a year, and people of color have mainly been the targets. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides shares her thoughts in this commentary.
In California this week, an American man and his mother did yard work. The man had a leaf blower on, and over its loud motor, he could hear a woman screaming at his mother to go back to Mexico.
Why do you hate us? Because we're Mexicans?
Yeah.
We're honest people right here.
Yeah.
The son approached to defend his mother and protect her from the woman, who held her middle finger up an inch or two away from the man's face. She called him a rapist and an animal and a drug dealer. She then specifically credited Donald Trump for the idea that this man was all these terrible things.
Rapist? How many people have I raped? How many drugs have I dealt?
The man, Esteban Guzman, is a systems administrator in Culver City and works as a landscaper and construction worker on weekends. As he said in a recent interview, he works 7 days a week and never takes a day off. His mother is the housekeeper at the home where they were cleaning the yard and where they were harassed, attacked by the woman.
You see how we're working hard right here?
Okay, sure what you're doing. You're also pulling it in everybody else's yard.
Everyone bemoans the loss of civility across party lines, but there's something far more ominous at work here. Recall, too, Aaron Schlossberg, who attacked women, again with racial epithets, at a New York City eatery, ostensibly just for speaking Spanish to each other.
So your staff is speaking Spanish to customers when they should be speaking.
No, he's being very funny.
It's America. Big up.
These kinds of attacks, documented on viral videos, are all too common, but each one is as shocking as the last. At least they are for those of us who, like those attacked in these videos, are Mexican-American, or Americans of Mexican descent. On a September afternoon in 2016, President Barack Obama awarded artists, writers, and other prominent figures for their contributions to the arts and humanities. At the time, the National Medal of the Arts was the highest award the government gives artists. That day, President Obama told the assembled crowd that he and the First Lady, quote, have tried to make it a priority to promote the arts and humanities, especially for our young people. Four Mexican Americans received the coveted medals, including Santiago Jimenez Jr., Rudolfo Anaya, Luis Valdez, and Sandra Cisneros, a 2001 MacArthur Genius Fellow known for her poetry, short fiction, novels, and most recently, a memoir. 6 weeks later, Donald Trump was elected president and another Medal of the Arts ceremony has not taken place. And one can easily imagine that if there ever is one, a ceremony to celebrate the arts and artists, the recipients would not be Mexican Americans. Trump began his presidential campaign on day one denigrating Mexicans, calling them rapists, and soon after that questioned the credentials and abilities of a judge just for being Mexican American. Other examples of the ongoing persecution of people of color, and more specifically here, of Mexicans and Mexican Americans, abound. They speak to the attitudes many have about people of color in the United States. The Mexican American, a twice conquered people, holds a particularly curious position among other people of color in the United States in that most Mexican Americans are not immigrants. Some are, of course, but the majority of this large minority group have deep roots in the southern regions of this country that are 300 years deep. The citizens of Granjeno, Texas, for example, have hard evidence in the form of land grants to prove their deep roots and the ways in which they did not cross the river, but were instead crossed by the river, to paraphrase a lament oft quoted by Mexican Americans. Just about everyone in this small town of 300 has either served in the United States military or is related to veterans and fallen heroes of all the wars of the 20th century and maintained that dubious honor well into the 21st. Yet still they live in the shadow of a wall erected under the Bush administration and in the shadow now of the threat of Trump's wall. Most of them have said they don't want it because it will mean their land is usurped again. Like Native Americans who have endured persecution for as long as this country has existed, there seems to be hopeless little to be done except to reject the stereotypes and unfair treatment. In his semi-autobiographical novel, And the Earth Did Not Swallow Him, Tomas Rivera's protagonist Marcos climbs a tree and thinks he sees someone else sitting in another tree across the way. The shy boy uncharacteristically calls attention to himself and waves to the person he imagines. He does it, he says, so they would know that I was there. It is a quiet, dignified act of civility. Mexican Americans are here. As film director and recipient of a National Medal of the Arts given to him by President Obama in 2016, Luis Valdez has said, "We're here, we've been here, and we're not going anywhere. Where would we go?" Deportations and detentions, as thousands of children and adults are experiencing now, notwithstanding, where would we go? On that September day in 2016, President Barack Obama awarded those National Medals of the Arts. He emphasized that he believes, quote, that the arts and the humanities are in many ways reflective of our national soul. They are central to who we are as Americans, dreamers and storytellers and innovators and visionaries. So what is our national soul today? What elements are soul? What hope is there for those dreamers or storytellers, those innovators and visionaries, if they are Mexican-American or Mexican or part of another group of people of color that is so openly silenced and denigrated with impunity every day in the United States? In that television interview, Esteban Guzman, with an expression that showed his quiet, dignified civility, but that also betrayed his discomfort, said, "I'm not the person that the President of the United States says I am. People look at me and they see what he said on TV, and that's not true. That's not true for any of us."
Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides is a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.